part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part. Fanboy.com.
This is Part-Time Fanboy. I am Christian Horn, and I'm joined again by Jason Holtham, who has been with us for the past two episodes, is now joining us for his inaugural third episode. This might make you an official Part-Time Fanboy.
Hey.
Three episodes in a row.
He'll be picking up the tattoo next week.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to get you drunk and take you to the tattoo parlor.
We're supposed to wait for the tattoo?
It's a pretty intense tattoo. And we are rejoined again by the always, what do I say about Paul? I can't say enough good things about Paul. Like, always
so
great Paul Edwards. Like, it's been too long, Paul. It's been too long since we've even spoken, like, in
yes.
on the phone or anything. So
yes, I agree.
It's been a busy fall.
It's tough when life takes over sometimes, but hey, that's the part time, you know.
Yeah,
fanboy, you know, it's part time for the schedule, but it's full time in the heart.
Yeah,
know?
Exactly. Right here in the chest. That's where it matters. So we are here this week to discuss, well, Paul and I did sort of like a part-time fanboy book club. We were doing this sort of on a semi-regular basis every once in a while with just different comics. But Paul and I talked about Preacher like in August, which I can't believe it's been since August.
Oh my God.
That we did that.
It's been August?
Yeah. At least according to the website. And since August, the trailer for the Preacher TV show premiered for AMC, and that got me to thinking, well, I had said on that podcast, like, I really just want to reread the whole series over again. So what I want to do, and if we can do it, is for, you know, a couple episodes here and there, kind of turn the Part-Time Fanboy podcast into the Preacher podcast.
Yeah, that sounds fucking phenomenal, man.
Yeah.
That's going to be really bloody and violent.
Yeah. And so what we're going to do is go at them like an arc at a time.
All right.
And we already did the first four issues. So that was like the first arc. And Paul and I discussed that. And I'll put a link on you know, this episode to redirect everyone to that if they want to listen to that. But that was pretty much the introduction of everyone, like Jesse, Tulip, Cassidy, Arseface.
Right.
You know.
So we basically did the first half of the Gone to Texas
trade.
Collection.
Yeah.
Right. For the people who are following along at home.
Exactly. And so this will be the next arc is three issues. And the first issue that it starts with calls Say a Prayer for Seven Bullets. So we'll probably just call this one Say a Prayer for Seven Bullets. Because
nice, dude. That's a great title. Dude, can I mention like how good these titles were?
They're awesome.
The run of the series.
God.
Yeah.
You know, like he's getting song titles. He's getting like just obscure lines from like Pogue songs or like, you know, like just sort of riffing on fun things. These titles are really good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing is I've gone on and on about like in person, you know, Paul's known me for a while as well. And Paul and I used to just talk about Preacher when the actual series was coming out. Like that's how long we've been friends. So yeah, I mean, the titles, everything, the covers and, you know, the stories. I love this series and rereading it has just reinforced how great it is to me, how crazy it is, but how great it is.
I haven't looked at this in a while. Like I have the whole series, like all of the trades, but they're still in storage in Texas. I'll be getting them back. And I haven't actually like cracked them open in a while. And I forgot how great and funny and weird, so weird,
this chunk
is.
Dude, I'll tell you how old it's been. I got my copy of the Gone to Texas trade paperback, and I swear there is like some sort of like strange mutant bug crawling around in the book right now. Like, that's how long it's been since I've read it is because like it's been out in the garage for ages, you know, and then like when I brought it back in for that last one that we did, you know, I just fell right into it, you know, like it's like the way this arc opens up, dude. You know, like you just finished up the first one, the first words on the page, a copy of Anal Rampage.
Please. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It starts off very mysteriously in like what would be sort of considered the seedy Times Square, you know, area that doesn't even really exist anymore, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, there's sort of like a mysterious purchase of said Anal Rampage. And, you know, I mean, that sort of sets the tone right there.
Right, right. And then that's just like one page. And then, like, boom, suddenly you're in, like, a 70s cop, you know, TV show or something.
Yeah, yeah, like an 80s cop. Like, you're introduced to Detective John Toole, who is...
That's a great name. Such a great name.
Yeah, it's such a great name.
And he lives up to it.
Yeah, he totally lives up to it. But he's sort of like, I would assume, the Danny Glover template, but sort of worse, like more pathetic than, you know, Danny Glover was in Lethal Weapon in this pairing.
Oh, totally.
Right. It's such great satire of that. Like, such a great send up of that.
Yeah.
And right, just right on.
Yeah. And you're introduced to him and his partner, Paul Bridges, right?
Right, right.
Yep.
Yeah.
You actually get the title, like, Say a Prayer for Seven Bullets, right next to a close up on Tool's face.
Yeah.
Like, it's the first time you're getting, like, a really close shot on those, you know, really expressive faces that, you know, Dylan did. And, like, yeah, it's perfect. It's almost like a little freeze frame from a movie, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, he's like, not only like the unluckiest cop in the world, which is how he introduced himself, but he's just like,
tool. Yeah.
He's just such a tool.
Yes. Like, he's just a schlub, man. Like, and what's funny about it is just how relatable he is too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he's the guy, like, you know, if you had this job, like, you know, the homicide cop, you know, that you would just fuck it up. You'd be dead.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, I wouldn't live out there on the street or anything like that. And right. I would be dead. The same thing happens to him, you know?
Yes. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, I mean, and that is a perfect, you know, full page moment where he basically, they're chasing down some guys in the alleyway, and the guy's got like an Uzi who he's facing down, and he runs out of bullets. He's got the guy cornered, he's got the drop on him, and he pulls the trigger and it's like click. So, and that's
A Prayer for Seven Bullets.
Yeah, like, exactly. Oh. Yeah,
and then that's when we're introduced to Paulie Bridges, you know, who like is
Mel Gibson.
Oh no, dude, I'd say he's almost more like a Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, Dirty Harry.
Don't you think? Like he's a very, he's like the quintessential, like, hard-nosed big city cop.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, cold as hell, mean as hell. I mean, he, you know, shoots a hole in a guy's face is the first thing we see.
Yeah, that's how we're introduced to him.
I'll be honest with you. In my head, he's like young Lee Marvin. You know what I mean?
I could see that, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. But he basically comes and saves Tool's butt, you know, and kind of like lays down the law a little bit on one of these punks, you know, shoves a gun in his mouth and is like, you know, threatening him for mouthing off to him and his partner.
Right.
Yeah.
And then he just pulls in the dude whose face he like blew half off.
Yeah.
And it's really funny. It's almost like a Roadrunner gag. Like,
yeah.
This book about like how mauled a person can get and still be like sort of self-aware of what's going on and then continue to like act in the panels, you know?
Yes. Especially this arc. I feel like this arc is so heavy on the like torture as we get into in just a couple more pages. Like, it's really, I'd forgotten like the depths of the violence and just the sadistic, the sadism of it. That's like, right. Wow.
Yeah, yeah, wow, yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and Dylan is just great. Like, his storytelling is fantastic. I said this in the last episode that we did about Preacher, but just like you said, Paul, like, that is not necessarily what I would consider like a quote unquote realistic rendering of like a face blown off, but it's so good. It's so good and almost like cartoony enough for you to be like, man, that's messed up, but not be absolutely disgusted by it. You
know? And what's funny too, is that you see that like Dylan has such an incredible range of gore on the next page, because they throw you right into, you know, basically a torture scene where someone's face is cut off, and then it's implied that it's going to be nailed back onto him, and you see like the anatomy, and he can do gore that's very shocking, but he can also do it in a way, you know, that is sort of like cartoony, more like Evil Dead, you know, in a way. Again, like, you know, we're gonna just, This podcast runs the danger of turning into like the Ennis Dylan, like, you know, compliment zone, you know?
Well, it's what's looking, not to like?
Looking back at it, I didn't realize how awesome it was. Even at the time when I thought it was awesome, now I'm looking back on it and realizing, holy crap, this is like a extra layer of awesome.
Well, it's just really interesting because, you know, that torture scene that you're talking about, that's like, it's funny because you talked about like Evil Dead, like maybe the guy's face getting blown off, the guy with his face ripped off, like that reminded me a lot of like something out of Hellblazer, like where like the horror was like taken like really seriously, and it's really funny because they sort of set up that 80s movie, you know, 70s cop movie tone, and it's kind of like, oh, that's kind of funny, and then you turn the page like you said and you're like, oh damn, like, we're not playing around anymore,
right?
Like, this is messed up. Yeah,
and you know, there's always that element of danger for our, you know, intrepid heroes, you know what I mean, like they're always on the verge of like getting totally wiped out. And then that's where they come right back into the story. You know, they're sort of like interjected, I guess, into the story by way of like they're just in a bar talking. They spend so much time talking in bars.
They definitely hang out in bars, but it's really funny because so much of the character development is pulled out from that dialogue. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's really cool about it is, like, as crazy as it gets in terms of, like, the action movie and, like, the plot, it's just not afraid to be like, you know what, fuck it, we're going to take this tangent over here, you know? You're going to follow along with us, you're going to have a great time, and when we come back, you know, we'll pick up all that other stuff later.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, and I
stop for three pages to have a discussion about morality and responsibility and, like, how would you go about searching for God?
Right.
Like, you know, between an Irish vampire and a Southern preacher in a bar. You just have to roll with it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's really funny because I really felt that this was the first, well, this is sort of like a breather after the first arc, which was just like absolutely like towards the end of it, just like went crazy, you know, sort of like apeshit. And, you know, this is sort of like the first breather that you get with the characters where they're, it seems like their true and distinct voices start to develop and come out. Like, they're very different characters from one another and they're not all getting along. You know, they don't, you know, like Cassidy, I mean, Jesse digs Cassidy, Tulip hates Cassidy, Tulip hates Jesse. Why is Tulip like hanging around with us? You know what I mean? Like, there's all these, like, there's this real dynamic that plays out in that first scene in the bar, like in barely like a page or two, you know?
Yeah. There's so much going on. I forgot, like, going back to the beginning, like, because I hadn't read that, I forgot how, like, contentious and, like, how Jesse and Tulip, well, particularly Tulip, like, hated Jesse with such a passion. It almost becomes one note how much she hates him and yet won't go away.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's intense, but in a good way.
Yeah. I also felt like a lot of this arc is where the, well, especially like once you get towards the end, where the friendship between Jesse and Custer, Jesse and Cassidy, you know, really cements itself, where they really start to form this like bond of like, yeah, we're going to be friends for a long time. And then there's also, you know, a foreshadowing, you know, spoiler to the end, even at the, like in one of the, in the final issue of this arc, where they're like saying like, yeah, not all of them can be, you know, whatever, like jerks or something. That's not the term that they use, but that's setting Cassidy up for like a major fall, like down the line.
Well, you know, this is really sort of where the book starts in a way, like, you know, you had a great pilot episode, you know, it's like, we just came off of like the, you know, the first episode where everything's introduced, but this is really sort of the beginning of like the long haul for this series, you know? And I think they did a great job of like setting up all the animosity within the group and everything like that. And like, basically the rest of the whole book is about how those relationships untangle, you know? And you know, everything that you need to know about the relationship in a way is right here in this page. And it's a really cool setup. And then we meet his mate, Cassidy's mate,
Sai,
who is like, you know, almost, I remembered him being like stronger in a way, but he's just sort of like a bland character at first, you know what I mean?
I always remember this arc feeling a little out of place, like especially with those first four issues, and it's like all of a sudden they're in New York, and in a way it is an interlude, and you get the feeling like it sort of doesn't fit. And you know, they do introduce Sai, and Sai is a journalist, right, who's been a friend of Cassidy's for a long time, knows that he's a vampire, and Cassidy, I guess they were just leaving Texas anyway, and they decided to go to New York City. And Cassidy has known this guy for a long time, and basically this guy Sai is heavily into, you know, X-Files kind of stuff, you know, like aliens and stuff like that. And being a journalist, he likes to look that stuff up. And since these guys, or Jesse at least, is sort of on a mission to find God, not a mission from God. You know, he, they figure that maybe Sai might have found something strange.
Yes, that he would have a lead on someone who could get them to God.
Exactly.
And you know, he comes across as sort of a, I guess, sort of a creepier version of Kolchak, you know? You know, he's sort of a, just, you know, he's very eccentric, you know, and like has like, just has, he does have like great stories. That's the one thing, is like, this is where like you start to get those, there are certain characters through this series that have like almost like little great monologues
going
on. And he does have like a few of those.
Well, it's interesting because even just looking at this beginning, his introduction is fantastic, where they're basically like talking smack to each other, him and Cassidy, when they run into each other at the bar. And then they give each other a hug, and it's like, oh, yeah, no, we're all good, right? It's like, we were just messing around, you know.
But there's always that shifting look in his eye of, like, maybe he's not.
Yeah, exactly. There's definitely something there. Well, it's really funny because you know that this guy must not be all there because he's friends with Cassidy. I mean, that's just a given, right? You know, and you know that Cassidy is like not, there's something about that character even from the beginning where you know that he's not on the up and up, right? So this guy being a friend of his and being sort of like, you don't really know his background, you're definitely like, something's up with this guy, what's coming, you know? But he is charismatic enough.
It's interesting that, like, too, he's our sort of, because he's a journalist, he's our way into the story that they set up.
Yeah.
The mystery thing, you know, that they're setting up. Well, the cop part anyway.
Yeah, well, that's how they sort of weave into, you know, Tool and Bridges, where basically he tells them about, you know, the big story in New York, which is the Reaver Cleaver, which right. is... We find out that, which is, they have a great, and they have a great explanation for that name, you know, and, you know, that two different news organizations came up with two different names, like the Reaver and the Cleaver, and neither one of them would drop it. And so they just decided to call it the Reaver Cleaver. But, you know, he basically sort of explains that torture scene earlier in the book, because mm-hmm. you don't really know what we're looking at. We know that we're looking at something messed up, but now yeah. at this point you're sort of like, oh, that must have been that thing. And so now we're sort of getting into, somehow Jesse and them are going to get involved with this.
Yeah.
There's going to be an overlap here. There's a collision coming.
Yeah. Because he's been investigating that story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, a lot of the rest of this first issue is, you know, kind of a little bit more set up and, you know, Bridges kind of being established as the crazy cop and, you know, Tool being the pathetic one that all the officers make fun of behind his back, yep. you know. So a lot of this is like setting us up for like the big game that's to come in the next two issues.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but there is one really amazing I found, and I actually remember this from reading especially being from like the New York, like Jersey area, like you mm-hmm. and I are, Jason, like the scene from the Empire State Building where you know, you really sort of, I love Jesse's sort of thing of like the awe of New York being like, wow, it's like every movie I've ever seen like rolled up in one, you know, like mm-hmm. this is fantastic, like this is great. And then Cassidy being, you sort of get a hint of how old Cassidy is, how yeah. long he's been around, and Cassidy basically saying like, yeah, I was here for the opening of it, and he's yeah. like, what, you know, and basically talking, having that sort of like dialogue and Cassidy's like monologue about seeing it for the first time, it's yeah. is pretty great writing.
Yeah,
it's really great.
I love the beginning too, how basically like Cassidy is sort of the guy who's like questioning Jesse, like he's sort of like Jesse's like conscience in a weird way, you know, because he's mm-hmm. sitting there, he's like, okay, like why didn't you just like walk us into the Ritz-Carlton, why aren't you doing this? And you know, Jesse's just like, well, no, I mean, I'm just not gonna do that. And like Cassidy's almost like, in a way, it's like, fuck, this guy's too good to be true.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and this is where you get a hint of like that Cassidy wants to be better than he really is. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's yeah. his admiration for Jesse. Like, that's why he's sticking with him. He's like, this guy is sort of the real deal, and maybe the real deal that I've kind of always wanted myself to be, but possibly can't, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again,
I mean, it's
you
something
know,
to live up to.
Yeah, he's the, I mean, this is, dude, this book is such a great, like, alternate Jesus story. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Because, like, I mean, that's really the whole thing. It's like, that's what Jesus, like, should be. You know, he's the guy that everybody aspires to. Like, he's, you know, our Superman, you know? Like, it, you know,
right.
one of the things that's awesome about this book is, like, it's a great superhero book. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, these are like sort of really grounded people with powers.
Yeah.
You know, and as a superhero book, it works so well because, you know, like, oh gosh, I keep getting blown away by the idea, you know, of like Jesse being able to just say anything he wants and it happens, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of that, it's funny because when we were talking about Jessica Jones, you know, there's that character mm-hmm. in there, and it was really funny reading
the
this
Purple Man, right?
Yeah, the Purple Man, yep. Kilgrave, yeah. Where basically I was really amazed, especially in the issues coming up after like this one, how much the power in Jessica Jones really played out like Preacher. Like, you
yeah.
know, he just says something and people just do it or it happens,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And it's crazy because, you know, those limitations that Jesse places on himself are what make that interesting. You know, in Jessica Jones, the bad guy's the villain, so right. he'll just do whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But as a hero, you know, it's like that old Spider-Man thing. It's like, I can't share my suffering with my friends. I'm so, you know, I have great power, great right. responsibility. But that's what this is. That's like, this is probably the greatest power ever.
And what's awesome about Jesse is he doesn't bitch and moan about the responsibility.
Absolutely.
You know, like he's just like, well, fuck, I got this. I'm going to do that, you know?
Yeah. I'm going to take care of business.
Like, it's interesting how little he only uses it once in these three issues.
Yeah.
For everything else that goes on, he only uses it one time.
Yeah.
In this chunk. And he, like, there's a lot of it, I feel like, over the series as a whole, that he rarely uses it. I know later he starts enjoying it a little bit more, but mostly it is that responsibility. And he's always saying, nope, not going to do it. I'm going to do things the right way.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's really funny because they do a really good job of making his own self-imposed limitations make sense. You know what I mean? Because mm-hmm. we've yeah. seen all those John Wayne movies. We've seen all those characters that, like, you know, the Clint Eastwood Man with No Name movies, who are obviously characters who could be like, I could just kick everybody's ass, but I'm not gonna. You know what I mean? Like, right. I can, and that sort of quiet, stoic hero that has a morale. And you get it. You don't, it's not like those, again, those issues of Spider-Man where he's just like, and you're just like, really, dude, come on, get over it. Like, yeah. you know, okay, we get it. You're suffering. Like, and that's a really good point, Paul, that part of the reason it works too is that he's not whining about it the whole time.
Yep.
Yeah, he's a guy with a job to do. He's like, you know, super blue collar about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I love the conversation that and that sets it up, like the payoffs to these early conversations when they finally happen further on down the line.
Yeah, are just yeah.
devastating. Where Cassidy's talking to him of like, well, why don't you just make Tulip sleep with you? You can. Why don't you just do it?
Yeah.
And you know, Jesse
yeah.
just says, you know, no, like that. He's like, I love that. And that's a great line. He's like, ordering her to commit a carnal act against her will would be an unforgivable sin for which I would rightly burn forever in the fires of hell.
Yeah.
Wow. You know?
Like he's right. just, he's so matter of fact about the way he says it, you know, like, it's just like, yeah. Like, that's the other thing about Jesse is like, he generally, for the most part, he just believes everything that he says.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Or he doesn't say anything he doesn't believe.
Yeah.
Exactly. Totally. Exactly. Like, it's that cowboy thing, which is great. You know, that kind of Southern cowboy. You know, the line that comes up later in the books that I actually still really, like, hold to is the, you got to be one of the good guys because there's way too many of the bad. And it's like, yeah, like, that's an ethos that you got all that you can hold to, that it's just be one of the good guys because there's enough bad in the world, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, he's like, you know, again, he is like that Clint Eastwood guy, that guy mm-hmm. that's not going to bend no matter what, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's right. going to do his best to do right by everyone. But so anyway, like at the Empire State Building, you have that funny scene where Cassidy acts like he's going to jump off because he's immortal and can't be hurt. And, you know, he kind of tricks him into thinking that he's going to jump off, and he doesn't really, but still what he does is crazy enough, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, like, it's not just Jesse he's fucking with me. You've got, like, all those other people standing around on the
deck. Yeah, I know, exactly. Can you imagine seeing something like that in the Empire State Building? I think I would lose it.
Oh, my God.
Just defecate myself right there on the spot. But, yeah, and after that bit of humor, you know, then you get some messages about, well, you see some of Bridges's, you know, hidden world, something
yes.
that he's hiding
right.
and doesn't want people to
yes.
see. And it's sort of the part that, you know, all is not, you know, right in the state of Denmark, at least right. in Bridges, yeah. Bridges' world. I don't know how to do that.
There's so, like a million apostrophes in that.
Yeah, I know, exactly. So, yeah, and then, you know, as you move on, you get that conversation, you know, between them, they're shooting pool. Well, what's hysterical is like they've punched out the manager, the owner of the pool hall.
Right.
Yeah. And it's and not because he wanted to charge them for the drinks. It's because he called them like a redneck or something, right?
Yeah. Jesse. And as you point out, this is an issue break too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is the like, beginning.
And you know, back in the serial days, you know, I don't know if that, it doesn't matter as much if you're reading The Collected, but like, I think it's always really important to know sort of where an issue picks up and where it leaves off.
Sure. You know? Absolutely.
And like, you know, the last one picked off, you know, left off with like sort of the mystery hanging in the air about Bridges' life. And then this opens up with a dude like passed out on a pool table.
Yeah. Bloody
you know,
shirt.
Just like, I don't know. Is that blood? Is that like puke? Yeah. I can't tell what's going on.
Right.
You know, yeah. And then the question, you know, word balloon on it, getting back to the question of your responsibility to your fellow man.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. Yeah. It's like perfect placement. Yeah. And that's basically where they sort of hash out that debate, which is like, you know, what am I responsible for? Like, what am I going to do with this power? And, mm-hmm. you know, and it's really funny because it's almost like that speech in the Superman movie where he's like in the, you know, one of my favorite movie of all time, you know, where he basically is talking to his dad and he's like, I can do all these things. And his dad is like, yeah, but you're not here to score touchdowns, you know?
Right.
And Jesse basically right. says something to the effect of like, you know, I'm not here to use this to get free drinks, you know, or to screw right. people out of money, you know, and it just sort of establishes him again as sort of that, you know, straight walking man, you mm-hmm. know, the man who walks yep. the line, you know,
and Cassidy's going to be the dude who tests him.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because yes. Cassidy, if he could use it, he would just as easily, you know, he'd be Kilgrave. Probably.
Oh, dude. He'd be Purple Man. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And hey, maybe in some alternate universe, Purple Man is Cassidy who got the word.
Maybe. Exactly. There you go. Now you're crossing the streams. Crazy. You're crossing the streams.
I am not afraid to cross streams.
Don't cross the streams. But yeah, so they have that whole conversation. And what's really interesting is at this point, they do establish that Jesse and Tulip, they're like broke. And the one that's paying for everything is Cassidy.
Mm-hmm.
So you know that Cassidy yeah. has got, well, I mean, I guess you're making yeah. the assumption that because he's a vampire, he's got some sort of hidden funds or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, right. That's right. At this point, like, and he's just freely sort of doing it, you know, like, hey.
Well, it's entertaining. I think he's like really intrigued and really entertained because, you know, Cassidy's been around for a long time. And even then, he's still never seen anything like Jesse.
Right.
Yeah. Right. It's interesting. And so you skip ahead and you get to Tulip and she's in their sort of like flea bag hotel. And basically the problems that started in the first four issues with her, where apparently she's some sort of like paid assassin, start mm-hmm. to like haunt her again. She's on the phone with somebody trying to explain why she botched the job.
Right.
And why she's not going to come and finish it.
Chin off.
Yeah, exactly. Much like Bridges did in the exactly. previous to this. There's a lot of chin shooting offs.
What's cool about this is, too, that she basically catches Jesse, like, eavesdropping
yeah.
on her. So, like, again, you know, she takes care of herself. You know, she's really smart. She gets the drop on Jesse.
Yeah.
And, like, just stands up to him. And even though it's kind of funny because I think in this beginning here, even though they've been like at each other's throats the whole time, like you get a glimpse of like the way they used to be, you know?
Yeah, 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 that's true. That's true. Yeah. And you definitely get sort of like you get the idea that, yeah, there's sexual tension there, but like Jesse is not even, this is not like sort of a moonlighting thing, like where are they or aren't they? Like Jesse basically comes out and is like, when are we going to do it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And she basically is like, I'd sooner sleep with Cassidy. You know what I mean? In much coarser language than that. Yeah. And so you've basically got Jesse saying like, hey, you know, like I would really love it to be the way it was. Mm-hmm. And she's like, that's not going to happen ever. You right. know, because
they both have these like secrets that are blocking, that are in the way.
Yeah.
You know, like they've got that sort of mutually assured destruction of secrets about like what she's doing now. And then whatever mysterious thing happened in, is it Tucson or Phoenix? I can't remember.
I think she said she got left off in Phoenix with no money.
Yeah.
Like 27 right. bucks. 27. Yeah, so
back in Arizona town.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. Where something, and that's the thing is, again, they allude to like this history that they had, you know, which we don't know about yet. And, you know, but there, what I was going to say before too, is that there's this sort of sense of like, she's like, it's never going to happen, but there's this tone. I don't know what's going on in the book. Maybe it's because I've read it before, but maybe even when I was reading it the first time I knew, oh, you guys are going to do it. Like there's no, you know, I mean, and so that's what's smart about this book. It kind of doesn't hang so much on the tension between those two, like needing to play out. Like it's very upfront about like, we're not going to get ourselves involved in all that juvenile BS, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And then they give the John Wayne panel.
Yeah. Which is still one of my favorite bits about this book.
Yeah.
Is the ghost, the spirit, the whatever it is that's John Wayne, that Jesse, only Jesse sees and has been with him his whole life. And for a long time, when I first started reading the book, I thought that would turn out to be God. And I love that it's not, and that it's never explained in any way.
Yeah.
And it's
just
this thing that happened. That's so great.
Yeah. Well, it's very much what's that Woody Allen play or the movie?
The Humphrey Bogart one.
Yeah, the Humphrey Bogart.
Play It Again, Sam.
Or like True Romance, you know, with Christian Slater's character talking to Elvis and stuff like that. Like it's very much sort of like pulled from that, but it's just so perfectly executed. And in this arc, it's only done once, like in that one panel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just yeah. They're really sparing with his appearance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and as we go on, we sort of are reintroduced to Bridges and Tool, and this is where you sort of get the you see that Cy is following them for some reason. You're assuming that it's because he's on the track of the story, but this is all. These are also the pages where you really get a sense of. Bridges's sort of bigotry.
The double life,
And the double life where, and the self-hatred that he's sort of engaged in, right?
Yeah. I mean, like, right away they set him up, you know, that, you know, he lives in a gay neighborhood and, you know, that he lives by himself and, you know, he's just walking the streets scowling and, you know, like, you know, like he just, you know, can't stand gay people to the department.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. And he's really, really like, you know, playing it on his, you know, displaying it on his, like, he doesn't care. Like, this, it's really funny because there's a part of me that wonders. I mean, this book did not come out that long ago. I mean, what are we talking? Is it 20 years or something?
Dude, it's
got to be 20 years. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
3, 94?
We are old.
95.
Wow. I don't think you could get away with this today. Like, the way that he behaved. I mean, I think you could maybe, but. I mean, he's pretty harsh with some of his language and the things that he says.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, we're also, not to get too far ahead of ourselves here with the reveal, I think we're also savvier that when you see a character who's like that now, you immediately jump to the obvious conclusion. Yeah. And I feel like when I first read this in 95 or whatever, and, you know, I was 20 whatever, late teens or however old, I can't do the math, I was still like, it was not as, it was more shocking when we got to the end. It was not, it didn't feel as heavy-handed as it kind of does now.
Oh, that's funny, because I remember reading it and being like, oh yeah, that guy's definitely a self-loathing, you know, homosexual. Like he, yeah, I remember thinking that while I was reading it, but I did not expect to happen, you know, in the third issue of this arc, what happened? You know, the way the reveal played out was like, wow, this is genius. Like, this is crazy.
Well, you know, like part of it's really interesting just for, and one of the things that this book does is like, he sort of name drops his references as he goes. In this book, by having the characters talk about what he's reading and what he's seeing and what he's listening to. Yeah. And, you know, he clearly references, like, in, you know, a few things like, you know, feminist literature and, you know, like, you get the idea that this story is also sort of looking at like American masculinity, you know?
Yeah.
Because like you've got like sort of the prototype American masculine guy in Jesse, you know, and then you've got like, you know, when you look at the male characters in this book, they're all very, very extreme sort of versions of like what it means to be a man.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that like, you know, this is sort of setting that pattern up.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Do you think that with the Bridges character that Ennis is sort of like saying something broader about that whole type of, you know, genre and character, like how ridiculously, you know, sexually repressed, like so much of that, like action movie, like, I have a gun, I'm going to shoot you, this is how I solve my problems. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's interesting. I never really thought about that aspect of it until we're talking about it right now, that he's making a commentary on that whole, just that whole type of archetype, right?
Yeah.
I just learned
with
something.
With his super long gun, and also, yeah, how rarely Jesse uses a gun that way, and like it's never about the size, but Bridges is, you know, totally about the size, and it is. I think it is, yeah, trying to get at the at that kind of toxic sort of masculinity.
Yeah.
So, you know, Ennis is also he's a big like poker of holes and all sorts of things. I feel like, you know, he Jesse is the like the best because he's, you know, super masculine, like totally masculine, but completely comfortable and confident and
sensitive to it.
Yeah, very much.
Compassionate. Yeah, exactly. Can I say how great this is, this bit where they go to this apartment where the woman, the Tool and Bridges get called into investigate, and just the one panel where Tool drops his badge and it's on a pile of dog shit. I had totally forgotten about that. And when I saw it, I was just like, oh, this guy cannot get a break.
And he's spilling coffee on himself, like in the car over and everything. He spends a great deal of time like dropping things or like just getting shat on by life.
He's just like, it's terrible. But they go to investigate another victim, and and basically the Reaver Cleaver will cut off people's body parts and send them to their relatives and be like, I have your relative, you know. And this poor woman, she's seen them on the news.
Mrs. Conroy. Poor Mrs. Conroy.
Poor Mrs. Conroy. Her husband's scrotum has been detached and mailed to her in a paper bag. And you're just like, wow, man.
Oh, my God. And the cut on that panel, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's that moment where he's just opened the bag and she's looking at it and, like, doesn't know what it is yet.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's, oh. Dylan makes me laugh, man.
Yeah.
Man, is this your husband's testicle? Are these your husband's testicles?
Is this your
super dead?
Yeah, is this your husband's scrotum? Yeah. It's just like, and you're just like, oh man. But it's funny because you know what I was thinking when I was reading that page? I was like, would you even know what it? I guess you would. Like if it was cut off, I don't know. Like I was like, wouldn't it just all fall? I don't know. I can't get into it. I'm just like, So yeah, that's a really funny scene where they, you know, kind of establish established that, yeah, this is what they're investigating. This is the sordid stuff that they're dealing with. And then you've got another situation where it looks like Jesse and Tulip have gone to Macy's because they're shopping. And he finally gets her to sort of crack a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great one, you know. So, you know, he just gets her to smile. And it's been so, like, tense and crazy up till now, you know. Like, it's nice that, you know, they allow themselves just sort of a little moment of, again, and it's one of those things, like, it's the panel of them walking down the street, you know. Like, this is just a page about them walking down the street and talking, you know?
Yeah.
And him wearing her down a little bit by little bit, you know, like, oh, yeah, like, you know, that spark's still there. And, you know, he's seen it all along. And, like, now she's kind of seeing it, too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which she's warming up to him. And it's interesting, like, what you said, Jason, about her almost being one note. This is sort of the one moment that she gets to be like, well, geez, stop being such a pain in the butt. You know what I mean? Like, you know, we're all trying to get through this together. And she sort of, like, relents a teeny tiny bit.
Yep.
Not enough for it to be made, you know, like, ridiculous, you know. It's very subtle and really neat, and yeah, I really like that moment. That moment really stuck out to me. But
cut to Tool and Bridges eating meatballs.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I love how Tool's like, meatballs, and the guy and Bridges is like, special of the day.
And then, you know, then the Reaver Cleaver calls into the station and, you know, Tool's the guy who picks it up. And, you know, it's, you get sort of like the cop stuff of, you know, like, you know, trace the call.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly.
The other guy is just like, well, the guy who's supposed to do it, it's like, whoa, you know, with a mouthful of sandwich, you know. Like,
yeah, exactly.
You know, wonderful little, you know, sort of, you know, moment where, and like, you can see they're suddenly starting to tie all the story bits together.
Yeah, exactly. At this point, this is where sort of the investigation or the conclusion of the investigation and the arc gets set into motion, because the Reaver Cleaver is calling Tool on the phone and basically setting not only him up, but, you know, Cassidy up for like the game that he's kind of set in motion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then the team meets back at a size place, and, you know, like, that's a nice fun little bit too, because as you start to meet the people who have come into contact with Cassidy, you know, you meet, you know, they met him in all sorts of, like, different time periods, you know. So he has this great story about, you know, meeting Cassidy at Woodstock.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, basically taking acid and seeing him rip some, or get shot by, like, a Hell's Angel or something.
Yeah.
And then seeing him survive that, and then Cassidy feeling bad for him and talking him down off the trip.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And also in the middle of that conversation, Cassidy also drops the little bombshell that he's a heroin addict.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, yeah. So there's more to it than what it seems. Yeah, absolutely.
But he glosses over it, like, so, you know, so much that it's like, I don't even think I remembered reading that the first time, you know.
Yeah, I mean either,
you know. He makes a little joke about it. He's like, oh, I always get Catholic on heroin. And it's just like, oh, like, you realize that basically he's been alive so long, you know, he just can do anything to his body. And now he's an addict.
Interesting. Yeah. And I mean, at this point, you know, they kind of, he lets Jesse know that he may have found a lead on somebody who may have seen God, and that he's called the Big Man. And they're him and Cy, Jesse, and Tulip. It's so funny, because even reading it this time, like, I was like, the Big Man, wow, okay. And it wasn't until the next issue where I was like, you know. But essentially, this is where things really start to kick in, because they go off, and because Cassidy is a vampire, you know, You know, they leave Cassidy in the apartment and he's got to stay like all day. And later on in that same issue, Yustool gets sort of like dragged in by his lieutenant, and he's getting reamed out because this reporter seems to know details about the Reaver Cleaver case that have not been necessarily released to the press.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so
at the end of this issue, you know, you've got a great series of crosscuts.
Yeah.
You know, you've got Tool on the phone with the Reaver Cleaver killer being told an address of a place to go and to bring a big SWAT team.
Yeah.
You know, you've got, you know, Jesse, you know, going out to look for the big man, you know, while Tulip waits with Cy in the car. And then you've got Cassidy cooking back in the apartment, and he looks at a picture, he looks on the bookshelf, and on the bookshelf there's those copies of Anal Rampage.
Exactly.
Yep, it all comes back around.
It always comes back to Anal Rampage.
Yeah. and the last shot of Cassidy is looking for, well, what's great is I found, and this comes back around later on in the series, is that he's not sort of like what we've come to realize is our stereotypical vampire. He's eating eggs and like toast.
Yep.
And, you know, he's looking for ketchup, usually like these days, or at least the mythology, the way it's kind of developed in the popular culture lately has been like, oh, they can only drink, but if they try to eat anything else, you know, they throw it up. But this is like, and later on, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that he's like, really? Like, give me a break. None of that is real, you know? And it's pretty fantastic in sort of like an Anne Rice sort of way. But
yeah, that was the Cassidy one shot.
Yeah, yeah, oh, the Cassidy one shot is so fantastic. Great. Where he goes off I love on that, all that, you know, Anne
where
Rice
he's like
stuff.
Going through the whole list of things. It's like, you know, what do you think about garlic? And he's like tutoring the like Anne Rice wannabe. Like,
yeah.
What do you think about garlic? Exactly. And it's like, I fucking love it. It's, you know, amazing.
Yeah.
Ever had a steak through the heart? I have. It fucking hurts.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, we'll get to that special soon too, eventually as well. But so the last shot you see of Cassidy, he's looking in the refrigerator, and basically he sees something that he doesn't like, but you're not shown what it is. At the same time, Tulip's feeling kind of woozy. Something's wrong with her. She's not feeling well. And Jesse's gone up to the apartment to meet the big man, you know, whoever that is, you know, the guy who's seen God, who they think is like a blind guy that can navigate. Is that right?
Yeah, like, something like that.
Navigate himself. Like, which to me was like, is this like a callback to Daredevil or something? Because there's sort of, I think he might even say like the kitchen or something. Like
that's
there's
funny.
This guy.
Yeah, like they're in Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah. And so basically Jesse's gone upstairs. Tulip is on her own with Cy. Everybody trusts Cy. And what is it that he tells her to look for? It's
look for like some aspirin or something in the glove box.
Yeah. In the glove box.
Oh, sorry, it was a Snapple.
Snapple, that's what it was. Maybe to settle her stomach, which I don't know how Snapple settles your stomach, but maybe it might have helped her feel good. She's looking in the glove compartment. He reaches in the backseat, and the last page of this issue is full splash page of Tulip getting stabbed through the hand with a giant Rambo knife by Cy.
Right.
And you're just, and he's got this giant smile. He's got this look on his face like, oh, this cannot be good.
Yeah. You bet.
Yep.
Oh boy.
And there we go. And you know, the last issue, this is where it all comes to a head, and it really kicks into high gear.
Yeah, I mean, you open up Cassidy looking in the refrigerator, and there's severed body parts in there.
Right away,
boom, from outside. You're completely surrounded. You see the cops surrounding the apartment. He opens the blinds to look out at them, and the sun hits him right in the face.
Yeah, and he basically knows, like, I am totally screwed at this point. Like, I'm not getting out of this. Or we got to figure something out.
Yeah. And it's really fun, too, because, like, it's a really cool sort of tense stand down. Cassidy, like, gets put in, like, a... And throughout the series, like, the characters get placed in these really cool, impossible-to-get-out-of situations.
Yeah.
And have to figure out a way to get out of them.
Yeah.
And this way, the way that Cassidy gets out of this situation was the first time I'd seen anything like this done before.
Yeah.
Man, has this been copied.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this is funny because I didn't remember how he got out of it when I was rereading it. And I was like, how does he get out of this? And it's just genius. Like, it's really, it plays out perfectly. You know what I mean? And it's just like, what a genius plan. You know, basically, you know, they raid the apartment, and I guess I don't know, is that a basement or just a back room?
I think it's his back bedroom.
It seemed like a converted garage to me.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, whatever it is, you know, Cassidy makes his way in there, and he sees the torture victim that we've been seeing the whole, you know, this whole arc. And he's like, oh, wow, this is like really bad. But of course, you know, and the guy's mumbling to himself, kill me, please kill me. Yeah. And, you know, in true Cassidy fashion, he doesn't kill him first. He decides like,
just leaves him there.
Yeah. He's just like, leaves him there. And he basically says like, basically pins himself to the wall with a knife through the throat. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And when the police get in, you know, I guess I don't know what the technical details are of, you know, Cassidy's vampirism, because he probably doesn't have a pulse, right? His flesh might be cold.
No pulse.
That's what I'm guessing, you know, because
he's,
you know, he seems in a lot of ways to be quite dead.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. The police cart him away. He gets taken to the morgue, wakes up in the morgue, and that's like a hysterical scene in and of itself.
Because essentially he used the police to put him in the body bag so he wouldn't be exposed to the sunlight.
Exactly.
And, you know, get out of it, which was a genius move.
Yeah.
Perfect move.
But, you know,
I assume the morgue attendant, has the sun gone down yet? Oh, good. Okay. Well, I'm just going to leave now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love how the morgue attendant looks a little bit like a bad Elvis impersonator with like that sort of bouffant too.
Yeah. Really cool. He's got like no chin. You know, I think the sun is the only thing that can kill Cassidy.
I think so. I mean,
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that in this kind of vampirism, the only thing that can kill him is sunlight.
Yeah, I mean, I don't recall seeing him like being put through the meat grinder in any way, like decapitated or anything like that. So they definitely established that one of the myths about vampires, which is that they're vulnerable to the sun, you know, is true.
Right.
Like at least this one is like, they can't go out in the sun. And I mean, there's no fangs like so far, like none of the fangs pop out. Like when he goes after somebody's throat, he's like literally ripping their throat out. He's not like puncturing them.
Regular teeth.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's none of
everything
that.
Everything else grows back. If he as long as he has enough blood is the thing. He can grow anything back. As long as he feeds on enough blood. And I think it doesn't even matter if it's alive, human, whatever it is.
Yeah, it doesn't
just
matter.
Just blood.
Yeah, exactly. And so meanwhile, while all this is happening, Jesse is going to be introduced to the big man. And the big man is Detective Bridges. And Detective Bridges is in the middle of his own little eyes wide shut adventure.
S&M.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Basically,
four-way party.
Yeah. Basically, he's been, you know, having people rape him all night.
Yeah.
You know, while getting whipped and having them, you know, call him names, and you know he again. It's like
derogatory
names. It's the total, you know, self-loathing. You know, like, and okay, this is how he gets off. While Jesse's seeing this, Tulip is just screwed, you know. And here's where we realize that Psy is not only the Reaver Cleaver, but you know, he basically, this is like sort of his little villain monologuing moment, you know, where he sort of comes out and fulfills his evil plan, you know, that he's just basically wanting to fuck with everybody now at this point, because that's what he does.
Yeah. Well, it's a genius. I think that to me, and I remember reading it for the first time, was like, wow, this is really heavy, because basically, like, he was driving drunk, ran somebody over, and then, you know, saw that he got away with it and found out that he liked it. You know, and from then on in, there was just no going back for him. And it's really kind of he's not like cackling, like twisting his mustache in the scene. Mm-hmm. It's very sort of like reserved, you know. And again, the panel work by Dylan in this is just fantastic. But yeah, you really get an idea of like how sick he kind of is and how non-repentant he is.
Yeah.
And also that he's going to set up his friend to take the fall for him.
Yeah.
Yep. Yes, he is.
He's again, like, you know, and as bad as he is, you know, he got there in a completely logical way that makes sense as a character and as a person. I mean, people get to that point all the time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's one of the interesting, you know, points in this book, that all the way through, people like go to really dark places in their lives, and you know, it's that ability to come back from it, you know, that that sort of ends up defining the people through this book. And even in these like sort of tertiary characters, these little small characters, like they all have these moments that, you know, sort of led them to where they are. And it's so well developed as, you know, as a whole, and, you know, even with like the little specifics.
Yeah. 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 I mean, everything, the way everything plays out, you know, by sort of the end of the issue, nothing seemed like fake to me. You know what I mean? Nothing seems like, bless you. Nothing seems like, you know, phoned in, or,
right,
you know, or it just seems like everything's really well thought out. And, you know, it's just really interesting. By the end of the issue, you know, you have this face off with Tool, and where Tool sort of gets the idea that you know, the reporter is sort of like, right? That's what
right.
he is, right?
Yeah.
It's because they don't, like, it's one of those great things where, like, Cy had this terrific plan that the cops would take out Cassidy and he would be blamed for it. And then he would wade in, he set Jesse at Tool's door, knowing that Jesse's a wanted fugitive suspected in murdering his entire town. And he figures, I'll just wait in there, shoot Jesse, and then I get to be the hero as well on top of everything.
Yeah.
I not only get away with all of this, I get celebrated, right? But it all goes wrong because Cassidy fakes dead, and Tool thinks that Cy is going after Bridges.
Yeah, Tool figures it out. He actually does detective work.
Yeah.
You know, well, like that, he puts it together, and, you know, and it immediately like ends up like getting like hit in a intersection by, you know, a semi truck.
Yeah, he's calling in like units to get over to his partner's place, where he's engaged in S&M antics and been discovered by Jesse, and he's not paying attention when he's making the call. So he never completes the call, and he gets nailed by a truck, like you said. And it's just another moment of like victory being snatched, you know, from his, you know, from his hands. But in the end, it's really funny, because it's like as unlucky as Tool is, whatever happens to Tool is luck for Bridges, because Bridges doesn't get discovered by the department, you know, for being like what he is. And, you know, Tool ends up getting there by himself and, you know, basically almost saving everyone.
Yeah.
Not really.
But in between that
almost
time,
saves the...
Go ahead.
But, you know, Jesse makes him a hero because, you know, then Sai comes in and the whole thing goes to shit. One of the other things that I like from this book, from this issue in terms of, like, tension building and the crosscuts is while Sai is monologuing in the car, Tulip is trying to get to her gun that he doesn't realize she has.
Yeah.
And she's trying to reach it with, you know, having a... her hand stabbed through.
Yeah. There's a great, that great sort of like play there too, where, you know, her hand is basically stabbed through, attached to the dashboard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's reaching for the gun and she can't quite reach it, you know? So like she has to go back and like figure it, you know, get it out, you know? And like you do, you get a sense of like how tough she is because she just goes through all of that and then gets her gun and it's ready to come in, you know,
And save Jesse.
Save Jesse. Yeah.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. And that's when things start to go wrong because Sai has shown up, didn't expect to see what he's seeing. Like, yes. Whoa, what is this, you know, S&M palace? And, you know, Jesse, they're all sort of like frozen because at that point, Tool had shown up. So all the major players are there. This is this sort of climactic, like Agatha Christie scene where all the players are like gathered in the living room. And this is how everything's going to play out.
Yeah.
And it's the climax. And what
Tool gets the drop on everybody. And falls down and slips and...
He slips on something that they don't say
probably
what it is.
Probably lube.
Yeah, exactly.
Some unnamed bodily fluid.
Yeah, exactly. Or that. Yeah, exactly. He falls down, doesn't get to be the hero, but then Tulip shows up and tries to take out Sai, and he shoots at her, and that's when Jesse's not having any more. Out comes the word. Yep.
And wow, what a way to use it too.
Yeah, yeah. He basically tells Sai to die.
Yeah, fucking die.
Puts him in the jaw, tells him to die.
And he does. Which is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, and again, and you know, he hasn't been willing to use it, but you know, as soon as he realizes that Tulip is is threatened in any way, that's when all the gloves are off, and that's where you know it's like, okay, like that would be the only thing that would push him into using it, you know. You know, he uses it then again on Tool, you know, to get Tool's gun, and you know, puts a bullet in Sai's head, making it look like Tool took out Sai.
Yeah.
Also, I realizing like later why he did it. It's like, oh, they're like, there'll be no autopsy on this guy. Like no one was.
Yeah, exactly.
Like he just dropped dead for no reason.
Exactly. He just like stopped. Something just, his system just stopped. But yeah. And it, you know, at that point, there's this really, I mean, there's, you know, Jesse gets Tulip out of there.
Yeah.
You know, and everyone's kind of like left behind, and you're still left with sort of like the Bridges thing hanging in the air where it's like, you hate these people and you know, what are you doing? And you know, he just breaks down, and it's I think that's really kind of masterful the way that they pulled that off, because I felt bad for him. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I was
absolutely.
Like, and he's such a jerk during the whole series. And reading that, I was just like, oh man, you know, just,
oh yeah,
it really played out well for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really, it is really touching. And it's like, and then it's, of course, Tool's an asshole about it to us to just undercut it. But it is really like, it seemed really genuine.
I actually think that like it's sort of tender.
Yeah,
like
me too.
In my head that I mean that it's like a punchline there, you know, because he admits I think I'm gay, and Tool comes back with, are you sure you're not just fucked in the head?
Yeah,
and like like it's funny, but it's also, I always like took it as like a very tender like moment for him, because like he's relating to his partner the way his partner wants to be related to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like he's always wanted a guy who's going to be at his side, you know, like, you know, you're fucked in the head, you know, like he, you know, Right. It's like, you know, it's really interesting, you know.
Well, that moment, they're sort of in a weird way, like equals almost. Yeah. And it's
you know how you were saying earlier, like bad luck for Tool was always good luck for, you know, Bridges.
Yeah.
And in this issue, the dynamic changes, you know, by the end of it, Tool is, you know, he's still like a doofus. You know,
yeah.
But, you know, but at the same time, he's also like, you know, friends in a way with Jesse, you know, like he's giving him information, you know, he's paying him back for he understands that this guy's on the right side.
Yeah. Yeah, know? Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. And yeah. And I really feel like it's funny because Tool does come out ahead finally. And again, it's almost like a reversal where, you know, now that Bridges' sort of life as he knows it is over, like Tool is coming out ahead, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's really interesting, but, and it's, I think it's really well played out in the fact that it could very well be like, oh, you know, things are good for me, screw you. And he's not like that. That's why I think it comes across as tender, you know, as sort of an understanding. Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, at the end, basically Jesse reunites with Tool. They kind of hash stuff out a little bit. And, you know, basically Jesse's just trying to get Tool's help in getting the FBI to think that he's dead.
Right, to get off his back. So Tool, like, basically fixes a floater that they found in the river and says, you know, basically, Jesse, you're official. As far as the law is concerned, you're dead.
Yeah, but then he drops the bomb.
Oh, yeah, your grandma's looking for you.
Yeah,
your
exactly.
Grandma. And
Jesse's not happy about that.
Dude, that's the first look of fear I've seen on his face.
Yeah, you know? I think
legitimate fear on Jesse's face.
Yeah, and I remember being like, wow, somebody doesn't like their grandmother, you know? Like, he's terrified. And you know,
terrified.
It's definitely, you know, foreshadowing like one of the greatest arcs in the series, in my opinion.
Yep. Oh man, the next arc coming up is my favorite part of the series. Like, it's, I really, really love it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's interesting because this arc here, you know, it ends with Jesse and Cassidy sort of parting ways.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a lot like those first four issues where it's almost like they didn't know if they were going to keep going.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
or that they were going to have, like, it was almost like we might never see Cassidy in this book again.
Yeah,
like, or that was it. He just passes into the rest of it. Like, it didn't seem like he'd be that important a figure.
Yeah.
As he becomes,
yeah. You know? Well,
it's cool. I really like it because, like, you know, sort of the whole structure of the series is like a road trip. You know, it's like a giant road trip that goes all around the world and, you know, different places. And, you know, when they get to the end of every sort of little mini arc, they give it a nice little sort of satisfying conclusion, you know, like treating it almost like a season of television, you know?
Yeah. Interesting.
And this was such a nice little satisfying end to, you know, what they had set up. You know, they give a little wrap up there. He and, you know, Jesse and Cassidy are friends, you know, even though they're parting ways, you know, they're good.
There's
a little catch up on, like, Tool, you know, he, you know, hero cop, you know, but then, like, he loses both of his arms.
Well, they do like an American graffiti sort of thing.
Exactly.
End, right. Where it's like, you know, this is what happened to them in the future, which is sort of what makes me go, like, they're capping it off in a way. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's like sort of a jokey end to it, too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, Cassidy, you know, getting into a fight, basically Cassidy's daredevil moment, you know, where he's on the trash can
and
all the guys around him and everything. And then, you know,
who you call Jesse, a guinea.
Yeah. And then, you know, Jesse and Tulip riding out, you know, leaving Texas.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, they've hit the road. And I love the end. It says, you know, 10 million stories in the naked city, and not all of them have a moral.
No, they're going into Texas.
Well, they're going back in. They're going back into Texas. From New York.
Interesting. Yeah, and so that's like three issues of the second arc of Preacher, which we just capped off. Yeah. Which I'm excited to read the rest. How about you guys?
I'm hooked again.
Hooked. I'm so hooked. It's just like so awesome. I this just got me really psyched to read the thing. And you know, when I saw that trailer for the AMC show, I was like, there was a part of me that's like, oh, so this really doesn't have a lot to do with the book, because I didn't get a feel of, you know, what had happened, you know, in the comic. And I understand that this is sort of like a pre-9/11 thing. So I'm like, just kind of like, I mean, Preacher, the comic, is a pre-9/11 thing. So there's definitely going to be changes along the way. But I just love this book so much. Like, to me, it's just a perfect moment and a perfect time, and came across it at like the perfect time for me to enjoy it. So, you know, hopefully we can keep going with these up until the end of the series.
I will officially call this book, I mean, the best damn comic book in the world. That's how I'm going to refer it to. Best damn comic book in the world.
Yeah, I'm saying, I've always said it, and this is just reminding me of it. You know, I think this is like my favorite comic of all time. Screw Watchmen, screw, you know, all that other stuff that everyone, Dark Knight Returns, like, this to me is like, it was one of the greatest reading experiences I've ever had reading a comic, and it still holds up, which makes me happy.
It holds up.
Cool.
It's in a three-way tie for one for me, because I'm a Sandman and a Why the Last Man guy.
Oh, gotcha.
And so those three hold like an equal place of importance and love and beauty for me in terms of like the comics I've read that are like, those are the ones I own and love and reread and like think about on a regular basis. So
haven't read Sandman to this day.
Wow.
Really?
I read the first trade. I've told you guys.
You've either got to read that soon or just never read it, man. Never do it. Because you can, then that can be like, you know, your every, can for the rest of your life, people can be shocked that you never read Sandman.
Well, you know, I did read the first trade, and I just, but everyone's like, you got to get past the first trade. And I'm like, come on, guys, I got to get past the first trade. All right. Maybe someday, maybe we'll do Sandman someday.
I will happily go on that journey with you. I would just happily read went back into the world for Overture, and I still love it.
Okay.
Still
cool. Well, let's finish Preacher first. All right. So this has been the second arc of Preacher. We're going to come back to it in a couple of weeks. Next week and the week after that, I have an interview ready to go. So it's a long interview. I'm not going to say who it is because I want it to be a surprise, but it's a creator that I've loved for a long time. And I'm just really privileged to have him come on Part-Time Fanboy. So great. Well, this has been another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. And I don't think, you know, I'm going to get a chance to say happy holidays to everyone, like, you know, up until after after the holidays. So we might say it now.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Happy holidays, everyone.
Happy holidays.
Have a Merry Christmas, and I hope that you get all the geek stuff that you want. And that's it. And we'll be back next week with a very special interview. Thank you for listening. I'm Christian Horn, and I'm on the line with Paul Edwards and Jason Holtham. And join us again next week for another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy.